Okay, so 70 years. Seven decades in Sion. We are in our final week, final installment. And as I mentioned, we missed a week in our seven-week series, turned into a six-week series. And we sort of combining the final decades of modern Israeli history into our last week. So last week we looked at the 1990s and early 2000s, and this week we're going to fast forward to today. So we're going to do this a little bit differently than we did in previous weeks. We're going to focus at the beginning on some of the moments which are much fresher in our minds, recent years, the last 15 years or so of history up until today. We're still writing the next chapter today in June 2018, and what I wanted to mention was for the rest of the time I want to reflect a little bit on what do 70 years mean, and what are we supposed to be thinking about as we celebrate really this this amazing milestone in the history, in the modern history and the ancient history of our people. So on the front page, as we've done in each week, I have some highlights, lowlights, highlights, as we've seen each time, of things that took place during this kind of turbulent history, ups and downs. Of course, starting earlier, I actually made a mistake. Operation Defensive Shield was 2002. I was thinking about the other one. Amud Anan, which was the more recent one, Protective Cloud, and we called it. Either way, there were a number of significant battles that took place in the West Bank and Gaza. One of the more significant moments, I think, in the last number of years was the Gilad Shalit deal. That was in 2011, prisoner exchange. That was after 5 years and 4 months, which is really a long time that he was a prisoner. Most of the prisoners who were released in the exchange, the 1,027 of them, were mostly Palestinians and Arab Israelis, and 280 of them were actually sentenced to life in prison. So the cost of that exchange was very, very high. For Israel, it was the highest, largest prisoner exchange Israel ever made, and the highest price Israel ever paid for a single soldier. But I think it strikes to the core of so much of what I want to kind of go into this evening, which is the fact that, and again, unfortunately today, there are still some remains of soldiers being held and aren't being released, and there's a violation, of course, of international law. But leaving that aside, this idea that Israel does not give up on its soldiers, and the price that we would pay for one soldier, one perspective of it is that's really dangerous, giving up all of those prisoners. But the other perspective is this is a child. This is a child of a family, of a nation, of a state, of a people, and whatever the circumstances around his capture were, which has a lot of controversy around it as well, he is a responsibility of all the Jewish people. And we prayed for him. We prayed for him as a community. We prayed for him around the world. There were those cards that were created. There was those special tefillot and gatherings and Tehillim gatherings for many, many, many years. And it was really an amazing moment. I remember I was living in New York when we heard the news that he was being freed. It was a very emotional moment, obviously a very challenging moment, and as we've seen, the theme of our discussions over these weeks has been that nothing in the state of Israel is black and white. Nothing in any of these issues is simple or straightforward or clear or clear cut. And that was obviously something that we celebrated with some level of fright and fear, but nevertheless, for a Jewish child to be able to come home to his parents and to his family and to his nation was something that we think about to this day. In fact, I had a sticker. There were all these bumper stickers that you may remember that were where people had on their cars, and I had a bumper sticker that said, I'm trying to remember the words in Hebrew. It's something like Gilad, Anachnu Rotzimocha Habaita, something like that. We want you to come home. We would like you to return home. And I remember that when he was released, I cut off half of the sticker so that it just read Gilad Babayit. Gilad is home, you know, and that was the kind of the happy ending to that story.
Was there opposition to the trade?
There was a lot of opposition to the trade. Yeah. Really not simple. That was
one of the biggest people who opposed it were the parents of one of the girls who was killed in Sparrow, the Roths.
That was
because
terrorists
were
being released. The woman
who drove the suicide bomber was released.
The woman who drove, right.
She drove.
Right.
I remember that.
Do we happen to know out of those 1,000 plus that were exchanged, how many of us
have been rearrested or got involved?
Many of them did.
They do have some record of that, because I think they track them.
Yeah.
They track them to a certain extent.
Yeah.
I'm going to come back to the disengagement from Gaza, which really kind of starts this discussion of the beginning of the kind of the last 15-year period. We'll go into that a little bit more. Some other kind of comments on your moments. Reuven Rivlin became president of the country, and an important figure for this time in history, for those who've been following some of the events that he attends and the things that he's written and the speeches that he's given. He is a kind of person who, in many ways, is almost, for whatever his political views, but his kind of dream to embrace all people and give people full citizenship, even the Palestinians, is a very interesting idea. He's a strong supporter of minority rights, particularly for Arab Israelis, and he's trying to create bridges. How it will all end up and how it will all... But I do think that he's being given a lot of credit across a lot of different spectrums in Israel. And again, it goes back to this theme of the Achdut, the unity that I think we are seeing. There's a lot of work to be done. There's a lot more unity that needs to be worked on, not just in Israel, but around the world. But there is a certain sense of unity, a certain sense of togetherness that the Jewish people, I think, has felt more in the last 10 to 15 years than ever before. Some other notable moments of the last decade or so. Dan Shechtman, not the only, he was one of six Israelis who actually have won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. I will not be able to tell you what he won it for, but it was the discovery of quasi-crystals. A small example of the incredible story of the Jewish people from a small place. The Ofek satellite, which was launched, Ofek 8, which was launched in 2008, is a series of... a designation, a series of Israeli reconnaissance satellites. This is the satellite launches made Israel the eighth nation to gain an indigenous launch capability. And just think about what that means out of the whole world, that Israel was, and I put it on here not because it's so meaningful to me or necessarily to us, unless you're in that field, and it really affects you. I'm sure it affects us somehow, but I wouldn't be able to explain it to you. But I think what's important about it is it just, again, drives home this idea of the impact of such a small place. I'll just share a few statistics. And I put on here the picture of the light bulb. I was trying to find a picture of, I didn't have trouble finding different startup company logos. I could put a whole book of all the startup companies that have come out of Israel. Israel is has the third largest number of companies on the NASDAQ after the US and China. Israel spends more money on research and development than any other OECD member. Israel receives 16% of security investments from worldwide number. Israel raises more venture capital investment per capita than any other country. From 1980 to 2016, the GDP per capita grew 6.6 times. That's versus the United States, which only grew 4.5 times. So just some small wins, victories that we've been seeing over the last 10, 20, and 30 years, And I'll show you later a really interesting article that was written in honor of Israel's 70th about a student who moved to Israel who said he's moving to Israel for economic opportunities, which some people would kind of smile at and say, you know, economic opportunities in Israel, maybe not. And at the bottom, just most recent, and I couldn't not include this, was the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, which was definitely a very important moment, a very significant moment in this past year. And there's a little stamp that was published this year for the 70th year celebrating Israel's 70th. Okay, so what I want to do is just spend a couple of minutes talking about really one of the low light and highlight in some ways, but one of the most fragile moments of this recent history, which was the disengagement from Gaza in 2005. And I'll just begin with a short anecdote that when I studied in yeshiva in Israel, I arrived in Israel in 2006 at the end of the summer. That was the summer, 2005. That was the summer of the disengagement, and it was still very fresh in the air. In the weeks it had already took place, it occurred in July, but the feeling in the country was still very raw, was still very emotional. Those orange ribbons, which everybody remembers, were all over. You know, we're all over the country. Those posters, those signs, those placards, everything you saw was really very present, and you couldn't miss it. And I had this moment where I was driving, it was the right after I had landed, and I was driving to Jerusalem to settle in my yeshiva, and I remember seeing a convoy of ambulances, a large convoy of ambulances, you know, 20, 30, 40 of them with their lights spinning at the top. And I was asking somebody, you know, what's this about? Turns out, I'm sorry, this was a day after. Turns out that a lot of people remember this moment of the what became known as the Hitnatkut, the disengagement from the Gaza belt of the communities, the Jewish communities, 8,000 Jews who were relocated from their homes and from their communities. What some people did not necessarily appreciate or realize is they didn't only have to move people, live people, and their belongings, and their possessions, and their shuls, etc., their sfarim, their sefrei Torah, and all the possessions that they owned, but they had to move the graveyards. They had to move all the bodies that were buried in these places as well. You can imagine, you know, what this felt like for people who were living in these places, who had buried their loved ones. Some of these communities were there from the founding of the state, literally from the early years of Medina Israel. And one of those communities on that day that I arrived in Israel was transporting all of the bodies to Har HaZeitim, to the Mount of Olives, just outside of the old city of Jerusalem, to have a new burial location for the community cemetery. And for me, it was such a impactful moment. It was such a moment of, wow, a little bit of a feel of what it is to be in Israel at this time, what the Israeli people are going through, what they're feeling. Just to see that was for me a really powerful moment, and it brought a lot of confusing feelings. Was this the right thing? Was this the wrong thing? Was it good? Was it bad? A lot we know today in the aftermath of those years. But at that time, it was unclear. It was really unclear. And there was it fractured the society in such a tremendous, tremendous way. So I wanted to start with just this article, just a part of this article, which kind of gives a little bit of a window in. And I want to share a little bit about some of the exchange that had taken place within the Orthodox community, which of course was very much on the side of being against this disengagement. But there was a voice or a number of voices within the rabbinic community that were actually, I wouldn't call it necessarily fully supportive, but definitely not supportive of, you know, soldiers refusing and some of the other things that we're going to read in a moment. So the article here is from Jewish Times from 2005, a couple of months before the actual event of the disengagement, and it gives a little bit of a window in. I'm on page 2. At Orthodox synagogues across Israel and the territories, a short prayer is being recited against the planned Israeli withdrawal from the Gaza Strip and a portion of the northern West Bank. The prayer asks for divine blessing for those sons who are living selflessly with perseverance in all parts of Judea, Samaria, and Gaza, asking to uplift their spirits and strengthen their heart as they stand up against those who would wish them harm. So Mordechai Eliyahu, who was a former Sephardi chief rabbi, there's a picture of him in the top right of this page, he asked congregations to recite the prayer as a protest against Ariel Sharon and his plan to withdraw in a section of the North West Bank, evacuating 8,000 Jewish settlers from their homes. And again, across the spectrum, as written here, majority of the voices were against. Avram Shapira, we're going to see in a minute, who was the leader of the Yeshiva Merkaz Arav, and many others who were not just against the giving back of land, but even promoting soldiers not showing up and promoting soldiers not listening to orders and refusing orders, etc. I want to read a story about a soldier. This happened to a person who was there. This is not on the page. This story was told by Rav Aryeh Zev Ginsberg, who was the Rav in the Five Towns, Long Island, New York. I think it's called the Chafetz Chaim Torah Center. So he got a phone call. This is the story. The rabbi got a phone call from a friend whose son was serving in Tzahal after he was studying in a Hesed Yeshiva. And he joined as a Chayal Bodeid, a lone soldier, in Machal instead of going to Hesder, and he served for 16 months and then decided to serve for another 1 to 2 years. He became a commander of a pluga, just below a main commander, and his pluga was commanded to take part in the evacuation of the disengagement from Gaza. So he ended up on the perimeter securing the outside of the community. One of the names of the community was Eli Sinai. And as part of the securing of the residents came out with drinks and food, and they were basically trying to convince the soldiers, you know, don't do this. The rabbi of the yeshuv saw this boy with the kippah, and they spoke and spoke. But the time had come, everyone was taken out, and this boy from Long Island, New York, was so broken, he ended up in that place, in that spot. He took out his knapsack, he took out his sitter and his tefillin, and right there he dug a hole. And he wrote in the sitter, Menachem Av Tafshin Samechei, which was Av, the month of Av, 2005, crying in panic. The Rav of the Yeshuv said, what are you doing? And he said, I know this is a mistake, but I know this is not forever. So Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people, will come back to this place, they'll rebuild. My children and my grandchildren, maybe one day, will come and dig up this, what I'm burying here, and find the sitter to know that there were Jews here once. Jews lived here once. And although they had to leave, they left their hearts here. They left their souls here. They embraced, got on the bus, and they left. 1 year later, this man, this young soldier, was part of an engineering unit that was commanded to go down south to the Gush Katif. And they were there to build up a headquarters for soldiers to be able to do missions that were going into Gaza. So all around him was all this debris. He lay down to go to sleep, said Kriya Shema, and he felt some discomfort under his body. He turned to his right, and like a madman, he started pulling at the dirt, and lo and behold, he dug up the sitter that he had buried a year before. He was in such shock, he couldn't breathe. The paramedics even had to tend to him. So he says, what's God telling me? What is God trying to, what's the message that God's trying to share with me? So he called his father, he told him the whole story, and he said, what am I supposed to make of this moment? Does it mean we're supposed to come back here? What does it mean? So the father said, I don't know. I'm going to call the rabbi. So he called up this rabbi from Long Island, Aryeh Zev Ginsberg, and the rabbi wasn't sure. He really didn't know what to say. He says, we have to go one higher up. We're going to go to Rav Chaim Kanievsky, who's alive today, one of the great Jewish leaders of our time in Eretz Yisrael. And he's somebody who can give maybe some insight. So Rav Ginsberg managed to get an appointment, and he went to meet with Rav Chaim Kanievsky. He went in, He told him the whole story. So he asked the boy, he says, what did you do during the disengagement? What were you doing? He said, and what did you do to try to stop it? And that was his position. So the boy said, I was praying, davening constantly, and begging my superiors, let's not do this. And I was saying under my breath, I'm hoping it shouldn't happen. And after, then he said, then what happened? And then what did you do? Once it was done, once everybody was taken out, what did you do? He said, he did nothing. It was all done. So Rav Chaim Kanievsky said, that was the mistake. And that was the message that God was telling you. No matter what the conclusion, we have no idea what prayer can do. Who knows what God would have done if you would have stormed the heavens with your tefillah. So take your sitter back and continue davening. Again, a story, but an insight into what someone was feeling during this time. So I just brought here two sides of a coin. And it's hard to take sides in this debate. On the left side, you have Rav Avram Shapiro, who I mentioned was a great, great rabbinic leader of the religious Zionist community, the head of the Merkaz Arav Yeshiva, which was founded by Rav Kook. And he says, this is a summary of this discussion, the letters that were exchanged between these two rabbis of Aaron Lichtenstein from Shivat Haaretzion, who we've quoted here before, and Avram Shapira. And they went back and forth, and they had this discourse about what we should do and what the nation should do and what we should feel. And Rav Avram Shapira, I just took a few of the points that he made. This is an English translation summary. Number one, he said, according to Torah law, it's completely forbidden to give land in Israel to a non-Jew due to the prohibition of Lo Techanem and due to the nullification of the commandment to settle the land of Israel. It's incumbent upon every individual of Israel. This prohibition applies to every Jew, soldier, and civilian alike. And in order to take part in the evacuation of Jews from their homes, in order to give over the land to non-Jews, is an order that is against the religion of our holy Torah and forbidden to fulfill. Every order that is contrary to Jewish law and compels one to violate the words of the Torah holds no validity, is forbidden to fulfill, and no person has the authority to deliver it. And then he talks about the Rambam. Anyone who violates prohibition will not be exonerated in this world and not in the world to come. Strong words. Then he writes, in general, the prohibition of handing land over to non-Jews includes helping those engaged in the transgression. Therefore, one must not participate in blocking the entrances to Gush Katif or assist in any other manner the expulsion of Jews from their homes. Similarly, it is upon every soldier called for reserve duty to refrain from showing up. You heard about it, and here's the writing. Here's where people said it. If a service is designated to enable other soldiers to take part. And then he had a whole bunch of other things that he wrote, skipping down. It is incumbent upon every Jew to do all he can to stop transgression. Every single Jew is required to protest. And the use of violent means is not allowed, but it's something that would only be, kind of the extreme limit of everything up until but using violence. And the last thing that he says is, who is the government to make a decision like this? You can only go to the Gedolim, you can only go to the great rabbinic leaders of the time, people who understand broader issues, or however he puts it here, difficult questions in all parts of the Torah. This is not something that can just be decided upon by leaders of the country on their own, which I don't think was entirely true, because I don't think the Prime Minister decided it on his own. If you look on the right side, Rav Lichtenstein, he took a different route, a different perspective on this. And it's important to just see how he phrased it. And his words are in response to what we just read on the left side. He says, with respect to values and principles that divide Israeli society, regarding which there's no consensus defining a particular initiative as patently illegal and immoral, selective refusal of orders is impossible. He says, what's going to happen if soldiers start to refuse? The result is a divided and disjointed army, part of which dissents and abstains from an initiative in one direction. And then he says, the damage to the unity and cohesion of the army, to the readiness for mutual dedication and sacrifice is clear. The IDF's ability to carry out its mission and power of deterrence are eroded. What happens to the respect for leadership and the military if we tell people that they shouldn't listen? And then he writes in the next paragraph, at the same time, they argue, there are military and political professionals who maintain there's a reasonable chance that the present government's plan will actually save human lives. And that's what they thought, that's what they felt. There were real problems with some of the communities in their proximity to where they were, to the cities in Gaza. Again, in the long run, and or that it will preserve Jewish demographic character of the state. There's no certainty about this, but in the opinion of many judges, there's also no certainty about the opposite. And then he asks the following questions. If you skip down to the bottom paragraph, the bottom of page 2 on the right side. published ruling totally ignores these arguments. And he basically says, you didn't consider this. We may actually save lives. So he writes, he says, do you simply deny absolutely that these scenarios are possible, being convinced beyond any shadow of a doubt that rightness and logic could be found exclusively among professionals who advised him? And if so, one asks respectfully, what is the basis for this absolute certainty? You're so sure that it's better to stay. Maybe we'll save more lives by not staying. Is it assessment of the situation, faith and trust, or God seek revealed to those who fear him? Or alternatively, do you agree that the dangers exist? Maybe you agree, but do not suffice to tilt the balance when deciding the halacha. Either because the prohibitions involved are so severe they cannot be overridden, or because the importance of preserving the integrity of the land of Israel outweighs considerations of life. So not only was the country fragmented, but even within the Orthodox world there was fragmentation. And obviously, it was a really, really difficult moment, and we are in many ways seeing many of the ramifications of that moment to this very day, economical, political, and all kinds of other religious and all kinds of other effects, security wise, so on. If you turn to the page 3, I wanted to kind of reflect on Ariel Sharon just for a couple of moments. And as we said last week, Ariel Sharon was a complex person. And he was criticized. He was also praised. He was criticized. He was kind of given the full gamut of what you would get, what a politician gets.
Every day.
But I wanted to just share two kind of eulogies that were written. One by Rav Aviner, who's the head of the yeshiva Ateret Kohanim, which is in the Old City, actually in the Muslim quarter of the Old City of Jerusalem. And the other one, I don't remember what the name of the author was. No, I don't have it on here, on the bottom of the page. So let's go look at this. So this was in the days after Ariel Sharon's passing, after he had been in a coma for many years. Writes Rav Aviner on the top of page 3. Arik Sharon has ascended on high, and many are left with mixed emotions. As are all human beings, he was a complex creature, light and darkness intermingled within him. We must remember, however, that we stand before one who can be defined as a hero of Israel. And you may remember in, I don't know if it was last week or the week before, we read an interesting, I think it was last week, about Yitzhak Rabin, right? Very similar, not the same conversation and not the same issues at all. But a similar kind of, we have to be very careful about pointing fingers, about criticizing. We have to remember the challenge of what it is to be a leader in these times. A hero of Israel, he writes, who fought with courage and strength, wisdom and ingenuity, especially during the Yom Kippur War. We are all indebted to him for his decisive role during this period. A hero of Israel, who had a major part in the settlement of Yehuda and Shomron. A hero of Israel who faltered in the destruction of Gush Katif, but surely, so he didn't agree with him, but surely believed that he was acting in the nation's best interest. His failures do not nullify his merits, just as the positive acts performed by Yochanan Kohen Gadol, who served for 80 years as the Kohen Gadol, were not nullified by the fact that he became a heretic at the end of his life. This hero of Israel purchased a home in the old city of Jerusalem, the Sharon House, in the so-called Muslim quarter, which he obviously doesn't believe that his yeshiva is in a place called the Muslim quarter. In doing so, he informed us and the entire world, and that this is Jewish land, the eternal property of our forefathers, upon which others came and built without our permission and presence. This hero of Israel, man of the military, man of settlement, and man of leadership, has ascended on high, and we're all indebted to him. A man of opposites has ascended on high, and we pray that he finds comfort there. A very beautiful piece, but it highlights that complexity, that challenge that many have of how do we read such a leader and such a person. A different, but on similar kind of positive note on the bottom half, it says as follows. All these contradictions made him a fascinating man to watch and deal with. And I'm quoting here from the middle of the eulogy, after quoting all the different things that it's hard to read his personality. Yet he really was, I think, a simple man at root. He saw himself as a Jew whose job it was to protect the Jewish state. And he shares an anecdote. This is from Commentary Magazine. In early 2003, President George W. Bush sent Deputy National Security Advisor Steve Hadley and me, who's the senior Mideast official on the NSC, to meet with him, hear him out, and see what he thought of the various peace plans. Was he open to compromises? What he told us, according to my notes of the meeting, was this. This is Ariel Sharon. I took risks personally, but never took any risks with the security of the state of Israel. I appreciate Arab promises, but will take seriously only tangible performance. For tangible performance, I will take tangible steps. Israel is a tiny, small country. From the Jordan River to Jerusalem is only 17 and a half miles. Before 67, the Knesset was in range, a machine gun, south of Jerusalem. From the Green Line to Tel Aviv is 11 miles. From the Sea of Netanya to Tokarm is 9 miles. Two-thirds of the Jewish population lives in a narrow strip on the coastal plain. Between Haifa and Ashdod, which is 80 miles, is two-thirds of the Jewish population. Our only international airport and most of our infrastructure. All of that is overlooked by the hills of Yehuda and Shomron. I am a Jew above all, and this to me was such a powerful quote. I am a Jew above all and feel the responsibility of the future of the Jewish people on my shoulders. After what happened in the past, in our past, I will not let the future of the Jewish people depend on anyone, even our closest friends. Especially when you saw the crowds cheering Saddam Hussein, who killed even members of his own family and government. With the deepest friendship and appreciation, we do not choose to be the lamb, but not the lion either. I will not sacrifice the nation. I think that quote is so poignant, is so important to encapsulate who this great hero of Israel was. So I want to shift gears as we start kind of winding down our series and our discussion this evening. And I want to talk a little bit about a theme of something that's been occurring, and you may have seen it, and you may have read about it, and you may have heard about it. And that is what we might call a spiritual revolution of sorts. And by this, I don't mean that, and we have spoken about it in the past, the number of yeshivot and the Orthodox and the growth of Torah learning in Israel. That's not really what this is about. It's partially about that. But it's about the feeling that in Israel, some kind of new movement has encapsulated the nation at large. And it's happening in all kinds of different areas. The way I would describe it is, it's a return in many ways to not Zionist values, but to religious values, or Jewish identity values, or Jewish spiritual values. The feeling that this is a Jewish state, and every Jew that's here is going to participate in it, not just because they believe that we should have a state, but that we believe it's a state for the Jewish people. And I want to highlight that through a few different incidents that have taken place over this last decade or so. And the first one I highlight is the speech, which some people here may have even seen, that was given by Ruth Calderon. This was a number of years ago. Ruth Calderon was a member of Knesset between 2013 and 15. She was part of the Yesh Atid party during that time. And she's a very interesting personality. She was born in Tel Aviv to a Sephardic father. Ashkenazi mother. Mother was from Germany. Father was from, had emigrated, but originally from Bulgaria. She grew up in what she described as a very Jewish, very Zionist, secular, traditional, religious home. Fascinating way to even describe her own upbringing. Secular, traditional, religious, but in many ways that encapsulates a lot of Jews who are growing up in Israel today. She grew up really in the 60s, but what she promotes and what she talks about is so much of what is actually taking place and unfolding before our very, very own eyes today. I want to just talk about two things that she did before she came into government. In 1989, she had a PhD in Talmud, okay? First of all, PhD in Talmud from Hebrew University. In 1989, she established the first Israeli secular, pluralistic, and egalitarian Beit Midrash for women and men. In 96, again, she basically went on this path to teach Torah to non-religious people in Israel. And she's not religious herself. So where did this all come from? So it's a longer speech. You can go on YouTube and see the whole speech. Just type in Ruth Calderon Knesset acceptance speech. I just excerpted so it could fit it into one page. On page 4, and I want to read this together. Because she gets up there in front of the Knesset and she opens up a Talmud and she starts giving a Talmud class as her Knesset speech. And I want to share with you what she said, which passage from the Talmud she quoted, and the message she shared as she was kind of accepting this new responsibility of becoming a member of Knesset. And she writes, she says, and this is a picture of her on that day, over there on page 4. And the title of her speech was The Heritage of All of Israel. Mr. Chairman, Honorable Knesset, the book I am holding changed my life. She's holding up a Talmud, and to a large extent, it is the reason that I have reached this day with the opportunity to speak to the Knesset of Israel as a new member. I was not acquainted with the Mishnah, the Talmud, Kabbalah, or Hasidism, and she gives a whole background of her upbringing and her parents and her house. But when I was first encountered the Talmud, she says, and became, completely enamored with it, its language, its humor, its profound thinking, its modes of discussion, practicality, humanity, and maturity that emerged from its lines, I sense that I had found the love of my life, what I had been lacking. And she also says over there, I didn't put this part in, that she studies Daf Yomi. She studies one page of Talmud every single day. I am convinced that studying the great works of Hebrew, this paragraph to me is the most significant and really drives home what this whole idea is about, and brings together many of the things I mentioned at the beginning about this this kind of evolving unity that we're seeing from on so many different planes in Israeli society today. And she writes, I'm convinced that studying the great works of Hebrew and Jewish culture are crucial to construct a new Hebrew culture for Israel. It's impossible to stride toward the future without knowing where we came from and who we are, without knowing intimately and in every particular sublime as well as the outrageous and the ridiculous. The Torah is not the property of one movement or another. It is a gift that every one of us received, and we have all been granted the opportunity to meditate upon it as we create the realities of our lives. Nobody took the Talmud and rabbinic literature from us. We gave it away. And I think here she's referring to the secular community who hadn't engaged in text study, in religious traditional study, especially Talmudic study. We gave it away with our own hands when it seemed that another task was more important and urgent. Building a state, raising an army, developing agriculture and industry. And you can't necessarily argue with that or say that that was the wrong decision at that time. The time has come to reappropriate what is ours, to delight in the cultural riches that wait for us, for our eyes, our imaginations, our creativity. Instead of telling you about this book's beauty, she writes in that second paragraph, I wish to tell you a story from the Talmud. One small story, the story of Rabbi Rechume, which appears in Ketubot 62b, and through it say some words about this moment and about the task I will set for myself in the Knesset. Rabbi Rechume was constantly before Rava and Mechoza. He would habitually come home every Yom Kippur Eve. One day the topic drew him in. Habitually, she goes on, she actually explains each line of this. I took out her whole explanation, but she gives literally a running commentary on each word and line. And one of some of the things that she says is she understands it to mean habitually means once a year. He was coming home. He was studying in yeshiva all year, and he would come home once a year. And the day that he would come home was Erev Yom Kippur. That was the day that he chose to come home. But he was studying with Rava, his teacher. And one day, that one Yom Kippur, he was so engrossed in his learning, he was so drawn in by his learning, that he failed to leave the yeshiva and go home. His wife anticipated him. Here he comes. And he didn't come. She became upset. She shed a tear from her eye. He was sitting on a roof. The roof collapsed under him and he died. Very tragic story, for sure. What did she do with this story? What did she say with the story? You're probably thinking, what kind of date is that to choose to come home? Yom Kippur Eve, it's not exactly a day of intimacy. It's generally a day of prayer. And not even at home. One day, one time, one year, the topic drew him in. Studying the baby drush so fascinated him that he forgot. He did not leave in time. He could not abandon his studies, and he did not go home. His wife anticipated him. Here he comes. One can hear the aspirant tone of her words in Aramaic. Hashta ate, here he comes. This expectation that every text message, every phone call, every footfall, every knock at the door, you are certain it's him. Here he comes. He didn't come. At some point, she realizes he's not coming this year. Perhaps a shofar blast announcing the onset of Yom Kippur was sounded, after which nobody would arrive. Due to the sanctity of the holiday, she becomes upset. This woman who waited all year, who for many years has waited all year for one day, cannot stand it anymore. She becomes upset. She's disappointed. She's sorrowful. She loses control. She sheds a tear from her eye. This is an active verb, not a passive one. She allows one tear to leak out of her eye onto her cheek after years of not crying. He sat on the roof, and as the tears fall from the woman's eye, the roof caves in under him, and he falls to the ground. And then she says, what can I learn about this place and my work from Rabbi Rechume and his wife? She goes on. I didn't bring the whole thing here. But some of the things that she said. First, I learned that one who forgets that he is sitting on another's shoulders will fall. I learned that righteousness is not adherence to the Torah at the expense of sensitivity to human beings. And the most important one she elaborates on, I learned that often in a dispute, both sides are right. And she goes on to say, and to me, this is so powerful. It says, sometimes we feel like the woman, waiting, serving in the army, doing all the work, while others sit on the roof and study Torah. Obviously a commentary on Israeli society. Sometimes those others feel that they bear the entire weight of tradition, Torah, and our culture, while we go to the beach and have a blast. Both I and my disputant feel solely responsible for the home. Until I understand this, I will not perceive the problem properly and will not be able to find the solution. I invite all of us to years of action rooted in thought and dispute, rooted in mutual respect and understanding. Very, very interesting, very insightful, very thoughtful, and I think it speaks so much to what is going on, this revolution that's happening today. The number of secular Israelis who wouldn't even necessarily call themselves secular, that they're fasting on Yom Kippur, that they're keeping a Pesach Seder, some of them are eating kosher, they're studying Tanakh a day, there's a whole website that's been set up, 929 chapters in Tanakh, where you have people from across the spectrum writing on the website, studying one chapter a day of Tanakh, and many, many, many other initiatives that are taking place, and it really is quite a revolution. Just another quote from a lady who also comes not from the Orthodox conservative community, but from the liberal community. Ruth Gavison, who's an Israeli law professor at Hebrew U. And she writes on here on page 5 at the top, my special challenge is not just to ensure the existence of the state, but also to ensure that it will include an effective legacy of Jewish identities, including those that do not require keeping commandments as a precondition for interest in Jewish history or Jewish sources. Only such a legacy, meaning every Jew has a connection somehow to tradition, but in their own way, will enable the continued willingness of most of the public that lives in the state to continue to support a state that is both Jewish and democratic. And these are some of the rumblings that are taking place. And to kind of shift gears to celebrate some of what has happened, I bring here a comment from Rabbi Fass, who started the organization Nefesh B'Nefesh. I believe they just passed 20,000. They've been around, I think, for 20 years, and they just passed last year 20,000 Jews from around the world who've made Aliyah through the organization, through their assistance. And he was asked in an interview last year, as they celebrated their 20th year, can you tell our readers one of your most favorite Nefesh B'Nefesh Aliyah stories? And he tells a story. One of my most emotional Aliyah moments was an experience I witnessed on a charter Aliyah flight. An Auschwitz survivor was seated next to a 9-year-old girl. Throughout the course of the flight, they got to know each other. It was amazing to see someone who had survived the atrocities of the Holocaust connecting with such a young, strong symbol of the future of the Jewish people. Together, they experienced this historic moment of the Jewish people returning to their homeland. I will never forget the sight of the two of them disembarking in Israel holding hands as they took their first steps together as Israeli citizens. For me, the experience was an essential reminder of the eternal nature of the Jewish people and the miracle of a return to Eretz Yisrael. And in so many ways, encapsulates everything else that we've said. On the left side, in the bottom, is this article that was written. Yeshiva University put out a compendium this year of 70 of different articles in honor of Israel 70. And one of them is about innovation and technology, written by a recent graduate of Yeshiva University. And he is now working in Israel in the Israel Air Force Innovation Department. And he writes, as an immigrant, I'm often asked why I decided to leave the comfort and stability of the United States and move to Israel, a country that has experienced multiple wars and economic hardships over its short 70-year history. Some of my reasons are quite typical, Zionism, my religious connection to the land being among them. And then he says, however, many are surprised when I include economic opportunities in my list of reasonings for making the move. And he goes on to talk about some of the things I mentioned earlier. But it's so interesting to hear people saying that today, you know, what's going on and what's happening, there's so much revolution, there's so much to be proud of. We'll leave some of the other quotes you can read on your own.
50,000, not 20,000.
What's 50,000?
That's how many.
Oh, you looked up the number? Thank you, 50,000.
I knew it was 50,000.
Must have been higher. Okay, correction for Nefesh B'Nefesh. So let's look at some final concluding thoughts. And an article that I saw, an opinion piece in the New York Times, Luckiest Jews in History. really a beautiful article, and encapsulates so much of what we're feeling during this year as we celebrate, and this series as really we celebrate 70 years of the history. And he writes, "Thus, when celebrating 70 years of statehood, we Jews must engage in a kind of balancing act. On the one hand, we need to appreciate the great achievement of building this Jewish homeland in such a short time, such a hostile environment. On the other hand, we need to grasp the smallness of this achievement in the scheme of Jewish history." He says, "The prophet Jeremiah described the Babylonian exile as a 70-year affair. We consider that short. In the 2nd century BC, the Hashmonai kingdom, widely viewed as the last period of Jewish political autonomy before the founding of Israel, lasted for about 8 decades before it became client of the Romans. This kingdom is still today a source of Jewish pride, but is also a cautionary tale. Most Israelis plan for a future that extends much further than merely another decade of statehood. So being the luckiest Jew ever is a blessing and a burden. The more we have," and I really like how he phrases this, "the more obligated we are to guard it, and the more afraid we are to lose it. We're afraid for psychological reasons. Jews thought they were lucky in the past, and it often ended badly for them. But we are also afraid because of indisputably dangerous circumstances. There are people out there who want to harm us," so on, and he goes on that. "Israel faces other challenges, some of which are familiar to many countries, economic inequality, populism, homegrown radicalism, and illegal immigration. Not even the lucky Jew can ignore these and other challenges that hover like clouds over the future Jewish sovereignty and success. Still, Israelis tend to be hopeful. In a survey taken a year ago, 73% of Israeli Jews said they were optimistic about Israel's future. They must see something beyond the challenges that make them so confident. One of them, I believe, is the sense of being lucky, of being born at such a good time. The number 70 has a special place in the Jewish tradition. The people of Israel make up one of 70 nations. Moses had 70 elders. Well-known commentary suggests God has 70 names, as does the city of Jerusalem. Celebrating 7 years of independence instinctively feels more than special than 60 or 80. It instinctively connects the mind of a modern Israeli to the long, complicated, and treacherous Jewish past, and instinctively makes him aware that what feels like a long and sometimes exhausting journey is barely one lucky step on the dusty Jewish road." And I want to conclude with just a thought, which I have thought about a lot in my own journey, our family's journey, that we are about to embark on, and it's a thought which I've read many times. It's really based on two lines in a book, a chapter that Rav Kook wrote called Orot. But to introduce it, I have two quotes here on page 7. The first on the left side is from an article, was an interview with Golda Meir in Life magazine. This was in October 1969. And a poem by Yehuda Amichai on the right side. So in the anecdote, I'm not going to read through the whole thing. She talks about this psychological kind of state that probably for most of history Jews felt, especially after the founding of the State of Israel, especially after the years of the Shoah, of the Holocaust, that Jews felt that the State of Israel was a place of safety and refuge above all else. She has this line of, you know, where she's asked, "Aren't you taking out your history on a people who had nothing to do with your tragedy?" So kind of a line of questioning, which has been, you know, you're taking out your frustration, you're taking out your anger at what happened to the Jews on other people, and winning a war, etc. And she goes on to say, "We had no choice. We have always said that in our wars with the Arabs, we had a secret weapon. What was the secret weapon? We had no other choice. There was no alternative. The Egyptians could run to Egypt. The Syrians could run to Syria. The only place we could run was into the sea. And before we did that, we might as well fight." So our secret weapon was that we had no choice. And in some ways, that's a defeatist attitude. To think about Israel and to think about the state of Israel and the country of Israel as only being a place of safety and refuge. Could it be and should it be something more? Should it mean something more to us? As the Jewish people. And I share here a poem which I saw just recently, and I loved it, and it was such a great encapsulating this whole feeling that I personally have, and maybe many here share it as well. And here's what the poem says. He's writing about what is a tourist versus somebody who really wants to live or be part of the of a true Israeli feeling, and not just a visit to the land. And he says, visits of condolence is all we get from them. They squat at the Holocaust Memorial, they put on grave faces at the Wailing Wall, and they laugh behind heavy curtains in their hotels. They have their pictures taken together with our famous dead at Rachel's tomb and Herzl's tomb and on Ammunition Hill. So this is the view of an Israeli looking at a person who's coming to visit Israel. They weep over our sweet boys and lust after our tough girls and hang up their underwear to dry quickly in cool blue bathrooms. Once I sat on the steps by a gate at David's Tower. I placed my two heavy baskets at my side. A group of tourists was standing around their guide, and I became their target marker. You see that man with the baskets? Just right of his head, there's an arch from the Roman period. Just right of his head. But he's moving, he's moving. I said to myself, redemption will come only if their guide tells them. You see that arch in the Roman period? It's not important. But next to it, left and down a bit, sits a man who's bought fruit and vegetables for his family. It's a really beautiful poem because it speaks to this feeling that we want Israel to be something that's more than just a place that we visit as a tourist. Even if we don't live there, even if we don't plan to live there or don't live there now, we feel in our bones that it has to mean something more. And there is no one better who captured this thought and this idea than Rav Kook, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, the great leader of the religious Zionist movement, who himself articulated such a stance. It should be made clear that Rav Kook himself in the 1920s and 1930s was yelling to the Jews of Europe, get out of Europe, get out of Europe, you need to find safety. And he didn't necessarily just talk about Israel as something more than that. But here's what he writes in the opening words to his book, Orot Eretz Yisrael, the chapter on the land of Israel. And he says, Eretz Yisrael inena davar chitzoni. Eretz Yisrael is not just something that is an external idea. Not just something that is a kinyan chitzoni la'uma, which means something that We have as a place where we just go, he writes, Rak Bator Emtzei, just as a medium, Lamatarash, Yitagduta Kalit, a place for Jews to gather perhaps, V'achazkat Kiyumah Chomri, or the physical upkeep of the people, or Afilo Ruchani, even spiritually. It can't just be that's what the purpose of the land of Israel is. And I just want to dwell on this for a moment. If you look on page 8, I shared Rav Aviner, who we quoted earlier, wrote a beautiful commentary on many of the books of Rav Kook. And in here, just in some of the footnotes, I know they're not footnoted on the page, the first thing he writes is, as I mentioned before, that Rav Kook himself advocated this position very strongly, that first and foremost, in many ways, Israel was a place that Jews needed as a safe haven. And he never denied that as part of what Israel offers to the Jewish people. But there's something more to it. There's something more to what Israel is supposed to be and supposed to mean. And he continues, if you look at the back at the bottom of page 7, actually one more comment he says here in the middle of page 8, I apologize, where it says 16. He says, Hashkafot shekaela, these types of ideas, Sharo'ot pe'eretz Yisrael miklat batuach, is like a safe haven. He says, that was what Herzl himself said. Herzl himself was the one who advocated that Jews need a place where they can be to get away from all those who are chasing after them. And Rav Reines, who was the one who founded the Mizrahi movement himself, said and advocated such a position. And he wrote on this theme as well. But there's got to be something more. And this so much encapsulates my feelings about everything that we've spoken about here. If you look back, the last two lines on page 7, says Rav Kook, Eretz Yisrael hi chativa atzmutit. He says, yes, it's true. Israel is, on the one hand, a safe haven. It's a place for Jews to gather. It's a place for Jews to call home. A safe home. But there's got to be something else to it. There's got to be something else rather than just something that's kind of a convenient place to be until the bad times are over. Eretz Yisrael Chativa Atzmuti Kshura Bekesher Chayim Imaruma Chavuka Biskulot Pnimiyot Mitziyuta. I'm going to have a hard time translating this literally, but I'll do my best to get the idea across. So here's what he says. Okay. Eretz Yisrael is a chativa. What is a chativa? A chativa is a unit. It's something that's been formed together. What is that? What's the meaning of it? If you look on page 8 in the middle, he brings a commentary. Exactly. He brings a commentary from the Aruch, who explains the word chativa. It's about 8 lines up in that paragraph. If you have a piece of cloth, a garment that's been sewn together by different materials, bad hatforot yachad. What happens after all these different pieces of fabric are sewn together? You create a cover of a thread on top of it, so it doesn't look like anything has been sewn together underneath. It looks like one piece of material at the end of the project. And he says, "Kach shalom roda uvda." It's true that it was sewn together by many different aspects. And that's how he describes a connection between the Jewish people and Israel. It's a chativa achat, one entity, one unit of being. Atzmutit. Atzmutit doesn't mean it's external to us, it's a place where we run to. It's something that's found inside of us. Kshura b'kesher chayim im ha'uma. Just like, and he compares it to, Rav Avner compares it to a marriage. He compares it to a marriage. And what is the comparison to a marriage? If you look there where it says, number 21 on page 8. Lo yalel adat she'adam yitchaten im batzugo rak mipnei shehi mehaveh ba'avroi emtzi'i greida. Person doesn't get married because his wife is going to make him great chicken soup or some other kind of need that she's going to give him. Me'achar v'hi mevashel et ma'achlim t'imin, delicious food or nice clothing. Mo'arer to intellect shelo v'gorem elo na. Maybe they have a good chavruta together. They have a good discussion together and it's great for his mind. It's not just about that. Adam yichatenim batzugo mipnei shakesher b'neihem ukesher shochayim. The idea of the marriage is something that is much deeper. It's much more emotional. It's much more of something that can't be put into an external experience that is felt between the two. Shnei anashim elu nasim l'adam echad. And that's what Rav Kook understands. The greater idea or experience that we can have is a connection to Eretz Yisrael. It's not just about feeling that Israel is a place that I could go, that I could visit, that people can go to run to. And that's true as well, and he doesn't deny that. But there's got to be a higher value, there's got to be a greater reason, something that's deeper, something that's more emotional, something that's more spiritual. And with that, I want to conclude with the words of Miriam Peretz. Miriam Peretz, many of you may have seen her speech. Miriam Peretz lost 2 sons in recent wars, and her husband passed from a broken heart. So this is a woman who represents so much of the pain of Israel and the inspiration of Israel, and she was honored this year with the Pras Yisraeli. The Israel Prize, which is granted each year to usually people who've contributed some kind of innovation, invention, won some kind of maybe a Nobel Prize. And she didn't do anything so significant in her life in those areas. But she explains why she thinks she was given the prize in her acceptance speech. And here's what she writes, and with this we'll close our closing words. Ladies and gentlemen, I stand humbly before my colleagues, honorable people who created, wrote, studied, and invented, people of vision, creation, and faith. I am not worthy. I don't have a creation. I can't point to a revelation I made or a formula I cracked. I have a heart that was broken 3 times with terrible announcements. The loss of my eldest son, Uriel, in battle in Lebanon, the death of my partner, Eliezer, due to a broken heart, and the loss of my second son in battle in Gaza just a few years ago. She recalled, with that heart, I came to my nation, and in simple words and the language of a broken heart, I spoke of this land and its legacy of choosing goodness, of happiness, of devotion to life, of responsibility, of social involvement, and out of that heart which beats with faith in this country and this nation, out of the great depth of pain, flowed springs of love. When the heart is full of faith, it can withstand great challenges. I turn my grief into a new melody. And I'll conclude with the closing words that she said in Hebrew and then in English afterward. Imrak nakir bekach, sherov hamishutaf beinenu, sherav hamishutaf beinenu ala mafrid. If only we recognize that there is more that unites us than divides us. And now you understand why I close with these words, really the theme of everything we've said this evening. Kulanu ba'aretz hazot chafzei chayim. All of us in this country are seekers of a meaningful life. Kulanu chafzei shalom. We are all seekers of peace. Zehabayit shel kulanu. This is the home that belongs to all of us. And no side. Ve'ein biladiyut shel ahavat ha'am v'amoledet letzad musiyam. No side has exclusivity over the love of the people or the love of our land. And with her concluding words, v'gam im yesh beinenu tehomot, nuchal livnot aleihem ksharim. Really unbelievable, and I'll just read the words, and we'll wish each other lihitraot, as was said before. And even if there are abysses between the different parts of our nation, we can build bridges between them. Bezrat Hashem, we should be zocheh to continue seeing the building of those bridges, the building of the unity of the Jewish people. There is much work to be done, but we are seeing and living in incredible times. And we have the opportunity to live in those times, to recognize living in those times, and continue praying and being part of writing the next chapter in Jewish history.